All right, we are here with Derek Varn for another episode of Pop the Left. Derek, we're going to talk about Harold Cruz today, and I guess that will probably mean bringing up questions about nationalism and ethnic identity, anti-Semitism possibly, and so on. But to begin with, maybe you can just let people know who aren't aware, who was Harold Cruz and why was he important to Christopher Lash?
Okay, well, Harold Cruz was a social critic and teacher of African-American studies at University of Michigan until he retired in the late 80s. He was born in 1916 and was a member of the Communist Party from 1947 until I believe the early 50s. So he was in there for a little while. Now, interestingly, there was a declassified internal file on Cruz under the Freedom of Information Act, where William J. Maxwell noted that Harold Cruz was recruited as an undercover Communist Party informant. He proved he was willing to name names of one-time co-members, but none of their actions. But that's not really understood beyond that. So that's one of the reasons why he became more controversial. He's also controversial because of accusations of particularly four essays in this book.
What's the book there that you're holding up?
Excuse me. Yeah, for the podcast listeners, not just people who watch the show, the channel, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, Harold Cruz. He was accused of being dangerously close to asserting that the CPUSA's Jewish members were basically doing a Judeo-Bolshevik conspiracy. He's largely been acquitted by that in time. Like, most people don't really think he was anti-Semitic, but that he was trying to keep anti-Semitic factions into a coalition around Black nationalism. So he was trying not to alienate the Nation of Islam too much, basically. I mean, to be specific. And he came out attacking both liberal and communist integrationism as being assimilationist. And why this was a problem was that because the policies promoted by the people he called assimilationists, which included people like Richard Wright and Lorraine Hansberry in the Communist Party, who he knew, was that it integrated Blacks into white society, but not whites into Black society, and thus betraying an inherent unacceptability of Blackness in mainstream America. And he said that this was done largely not out of cynicism, but out of class interest of a kind of developing intellectual elite, an intellectual of the Black community and its small bourgeois allies, who had everything to gain by integrating into white society at the expense of Black culture. Now,
okay, can I ask a question here? When he would speak about assimilating other cultures that assimilated into American culture, like the Italians or the Irish, my understanding is that he felt that they built up an Irish culture or an Italian culture that when they assimilated, that allowed them to assimilate, that without building up institutions, they couldn't have done it.
Well, not without completely. He posits that nationalism, cultural nationalism in specific, that was not separatist. Okay, so this is different than the way we normally think about nationalism. Created a collective subject that gave people the bargaining power to be able to enter, to set the terms of their entrance into an assimilated white elite. And he specifically focused on the Irish and the Jews. And Lash actually has some criticisms of him, because one of the things he points out is that the nationalisms of, Cruz makes a big deal out of the fact Jewish nationalism is not based in America. It is Zionistic, and it's hard for people to tell when Jewish cultural nationalism is our cultural separatism, not political separatism, is Zionistic, or when it's just about Jewish culture in America and in the diaspora in specific, unless you are within the community. And to outsiders, there's hardly any difference. And that this was cynically used, particularly during the period that Stalin was going back and forth from the creation of Israel, as a wedge for Jewish nationalism, which he resented because he saw no such wedge available for Black nationalism. And what Lash points back at him is that one of the issues is the Irish, Italian, and even diaspora Jewish nationalism after the establishment of Israel is a nationalism for a country you don't belong to. So it is a bridge from the diaspora community to the home community. It is not actually a competing nationalism within the country itself. What concerned Harold Cruz, and I was interesting, is this was talked about a lot prior to the 1960s. It is not talked about that much now. The only people I really see talk about this explicitly is like in notes, you know, the Communization Journal, where they talk about the need, since it was impossible to deal with serial or aggregate worker interest. Okay, so to figure out what the workers needed in aggregate as individuals and as a collective simultaneously, you needed a creation of a synthetic identity that was collective enough to act in a way that could have bargaining power, like as a political force. And so what Cruz looks at is he looks at the Irish, and he looks at the Italian Americans, and he looks at Jewish Americans, and seeing how they effectively did the thing that the collective worker was trying to do. And that the collective worker in America had left out Black people. And so even when Black people in the Communist Party would talk about, unify Black liberation and all that, that it did so at a cost, because the workerist image in America was white. And so to really be able to be an effective participant in a socialist subject, because he didn't totally abandon socialism, this is what's interesting, that the to get beyond a kind of lumpen proletarianized Black demographic block, that they needed nationalism to raise themselves up to not only integrate into a pluralistic mainstream of American society, but also to be an effective unit as an actor in a anti-capitalist world. Because he did realize, and Lash picks this up, that the Black Power nationalism of the 60s had actually watered Black nationalist socialist content down, particularly in Stokely Carmichael, and this is before like the heyday of the other Panthers that we really remember. And this is before Carmichael had gone Pan-Africanist. And so Black Power sometimes sounded assimilationist, sometimes sounded separatist, and sometimes just sounded like cultural nationalism. And sometimes the same people would articulate all visions kind of in just like this haphazard notion of Black Power. And what Cruz realized pretty quickly, and he said that the Black bourgeoisie realized this too, is if you tried to like just have Black capital, you will always be outcompeted by every other group in the United States, because they're both numerically larger and they already have, huge amounts of capital. So
let me ask a question that I think fits right here really well. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to create a cultural nationalism and you're not attempting to create a Black capitalist class or an Irish capitalist class or an Italian capitalist class, what will the foundation for the separate culture be? If not a capitalist class in another nation, like Ireland or Italy or...
Well, I mean, that's what Lash basically says, that Cruz, and I've read the book, Cruz doesn't really completely answer the question. Like, that the idea of this class is like, we need, you know, the experience of the diaspora puts us together almost as a class unit, that cross-class organizations, the intra-class organizations would be fair, but we need our own interests represented, or we're going to be, or we get steamrolled by this, you know, collective white worker.
And then the other thing is, like, when you're talking about a transplanted cultural unit that then will organize along class lines within the country, but have its culture maintained by another nation, the significance of that culture, to me, is a little bit unclear. I guess it will breed solidarity amongst workers, as long as they're not of a particular ethnicity, as long as they live together,
right? Work
in the same industry. But go ahead.
This is a problem, Doug, though, that we've already had. You don't understand the Marxist. Like, when I say you don't understand, I don't mean you don't get it. I mean, like, you don't understand why there's a Marxist detente to national units to build internationalism. Like, why are we trying to build nationalism up to build internationalism up?
No, I'm not. Right? I'm not even. I understand why we would do that, but I'm just saying, I'm just looking at this particulars of what it would take for a culture to have an impact or be important in a a transplanted national culture to be important for a class project, let's say.
Well, and also, like, the other thing about Black culture that Cruz realizes is that African culture is not homogenous, and even like Pan-Africanism only ever had a real appeal, like a big appeal in the diaspora in America and in other parts of the Americas. It never really had a big appeal in Africa. Like, there's people who've tried it, but it's never been.
Right. You weren't referring to a nation with a real ethnic identity. You were referring to a whole continent.
You're referring to a whole continent with a racial identity imposed on it.
Right. But an ethnic identity that was like with a myriad of ethnic identities scattered throughout the continent. So you didn't really, and you had, and a people who couldn't really connect to that continent because of the imposition of the way they got to America was through slavery, where they were totally cut off.
Right. Cut off. And even if they came back, I mentioned this on one of the early, I mentioned this all the time on different things, but I also mentioned it on one of the very earliest Pop the Left episodes before we were on Zero Books. That if you come back and you go to like Liberia, for example, that you're actually imposing, you know, African American culture on a culture that is separate from it, and was resented for that fact and created ethnic tension. So that even going back to Africa was not a viable mass solution. So what Cruz becomes interested in is cultural nationalism as a way to build a collective agent, both. You know, and this attracts Lash, because Lash is seeing an abandonment of the working class as a collective agent, as unions get weaker, there's a bunch of things that Lash is concerned about, as progressives have increasingly made working class activism more and more amenable to capital in ways that they don't even see. So Lash is looking to Harold Cruz for a way out of this problem, because the other way out of the problem that was generally presented, and you know it because it was like in Marxist groups you were in, this was still talked about as a viable solution, is since it seems like the quote unquote working class has been totally distorted by capital. I say the quote unquote working class, but I should put distorted by capital in quotation marks. And that it's been subsumed, that we need another agent, and the agents that we have are closer to the lumpen proletariat, or to people who do not have a clear class identity. And one of the things that Cruz realizes is that treating all of Black culture as a lumpen revolutionary subject doesn't work. Like, yes, a lot of them are shut out of formal work because of Jim Crow, but that's not going to get them anywhere. But that, you know, you saw that line of thought gets picked up both by the New Left and by the late Black Power movement and some of the parts of the Panthers, not all of it.
It helps the progressives.
Right.
It helps the progressive party not the progressive party, but the progressive Democrats to sell poverty programs along anti-racist lines, especially maybe now. I don't know about the history of it so much, but it certainly, if you're looking to inflate the intervention of the state into people's lives and have a justification for it, looking to the subjectivities of the lumpen as being the basis for your politics, I think would be a natural fit.
Right. But I don't even think they were thinking that far ahead. I think they were like, they didn't have a working class subject. The collective worker had not gone the way it wanted.
Right. I'm not saying they were. I'm just saying that was the consequence of thinking in that direction. Right.
Well, I mean, that's why the progressives were able to pick it up. Like, right. And Cruz is trying to think of his way out of this problem. He's also trying to build a coalition of groups that he's criticizing. Like, he's criticizing the Nation of Islam. He's criticizing Amiri Baraka. He's criticizing a lot of the other nationalists, and he's definitely criticizing the separatists and the black, you know, black capital, you know, black entrepreneurship people. But he's also trying to keep them in a coalition that's unified enough to be an effective political agent, which doesn't happen. Like, there's a conference in 1970, and basically this all falls apart.
Why did he think that the Communist Party USA, to the degree that he did, and maybe he didn't really think this, but to the degree that he did, why did he think, I mean, he thought that the way class politics worked in general was through cultural politics and racial and ethnic politics, right? So
I don't think it's entirely that. I think he thought that you had to have a unified cultural subject to have.
Well, let me finish asking the question before you answer the part of it. So he partially thought in order to have class politics, you had to develop a cultural politics, unless you were. And if you were in the majority, then you didn't have to develop it. It was already there. But if you didn't, if you weren't in the majority, right. If you were an oppressed minority, you had to develop a cultural group that would have power. That meant it had economic base, and Lash would say from some other nation, but it had some sort of economic base. But more important than that economic base was holding on to the identity, which could then be politicized, right? People would work together. Right. But okay, so there's that. Why did he then say that the Communist Party USA was such a cultural or ethnic group, and that it was actually the struggle for Jewish transplants to develop their own version of a class politics along ethnic lines?
I think a lot of it seems to have been the defection after the 1950s into Zionist camps. He keeps on mentioning the former Marxists. A lot of them weren't in the CPA USA, actually. A lot of them were in, you can always talk about the people who were in the SWP, who formed Commentary Magazine and all that, but he's watching them in the late 50s, early 60s become conservatives. Lash's chapter before this one talks about how a lot of these same people have been brought in opposition to Stalinism, have been brought into Alliance for American Freedom in the 50s, and who had like basically became Cold War agents of the OSS and and the CIA, and like, you know, he figures this out early. And so Cruz is coming out of that. Cruz also, like, the reason why I mentioned that little fact that it seems like he may have been an informant, is that Cruz also took part in that probably. Out of resentment to what he saw the CPUSA not doing. Now, it's hard for us to get our head around this, because at the same time he's accusing them of this, you have to remember, like, the CPUSA was providing party stipends of middle class lifestyles to black cadres, and when I like, because they had Russian money,
right.
They were able, like, Lorraine Hansberry and some of the artists were able to achieve a middle class lifestyle to do their art by working for the CPUSA, and they were also able to eventually get access to high level Democrats. I mean, like, Lorraine Hansberry was able to have a discussion with Robert Kennedy. Like, So what last?
Yeah.
What,
so why wasn't it a Russian project? Why was it an ethnically Jewish project?
Because in America, for whatever reason, the CPUSA, after the decline of the CPA, had a disproportionate number of ethnic minorities, and the ethnic minorities in there were disproportionately Jewish. And what I will say about that, and I feel like I can say this to some degree because I come partly from a Jewish background, there is a real sense in which the Jewish community was the least fiscally immiserated community of the minority communities in America. Doesn't mean that there weren't poor Jews. There were plenty of settled Jews in America, but they were not as poor as even the Irish were historically, or the Italians.
Right.
And were they always
actually more wealthy than most WASPs as they are today? Okay.
They were not always more wealthy than most WASPs, but they were always more wealthy than most other minority groups.
Right.
And the other thing is Harold Cruz knew his Civil War. He knew about Jewish ambivalence towards the Confederacy and stuff like that. So he kind of thought, because he's thinking in terms of nationalist blocks within a larger socialist polity, that a lot of this was self-interested for the group to consolidate itself. And unlike what he said eventually, and what struck me about this is the one thing he says that does sound awfully close to what you'd hear an anti-Semite like Kevin MacDonald say. He would say the leadership of the CPUSA upon the Jewish question encouraged assimilationist politics amongst all other groups but itself. And at the same time was arguing for Zionism amongst itself, socialist Zionism at the time. But I mean, and again, it's hard for people to remember that Stalin was, that Stalin had originally, after he gave up on the Jewish autonomous zone, he decided that the support in the formation of Israel until the U.S. started backing it, and it changed this geopolitical
calculation. That was policy coming from Moscow more than it was a Jewish plot.
Yes. I mean, yes. But it was experienced by Cruz as sort of, I mean, he never says it's a Jewish plot. I mean, this is like they're
right.
This is why accusing him of anti-Semitism is such a hot topic even today. One, because it brings up the shadows of inter-minority tensions that a lot of leftists just don't want to deal with at all. Mm-hmm. But a bigger one is that it's hard to tell. I actually, before it came on, I read the four essays in The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, which are about Jewishness or Jews. And I can only find one line. And that's the one I just told you that feels explicitly sketchy, but the cultural politics and collective identity, the collective nationhood thing to me, recapitulates the problems of nationalism as a whole, even as a cultural unit whole, because the collective worker problem already has a problem. The idea of the collective worker gets you into workerist politics, which is something that the Frankfurt School and I mean, even classical Leninism, classical Leninism going back to Lenin and Trotsky, they're worried about that because if you get too attached to a worker's identity, you have no reason to fight for anything other than benefits and capitalism, because your identity will go away once capital goes away and your ability to bargain goes right. away. And
if you have a party that's a proletarian party that has the interest of developing socialism, mm-hmm. not the interest of a working class group in a particular sector, then you can hold on to a proletarian identity, which is really identical with a socialist identity in theory. Yeah. But I mean, the question for socialists is, why did the socialist parties dissolve and break up and get eventually, either turned into tiny sectarian groups or liquidate themselves into the Democratic Party in the United States or other social democratic parties around the world.
So I'm gonna talk about.
But I'm just saying that that's a back in the background of this question about
right
culture.
But there was an answer posited to that. Like, and it was a political answer and an economic answer. The answer posited to it originally, was the idea of a Marxist center position. Like Marx had staked out a center position between the anarchist and the reformist in the First International, and Lenin had staked out a center position between the left communist and the social democrats in the Second International. That a Marxist center position needed to emerge that wanted to push beyond the collective worker. Now, there are two readings of what this ends up doing. All right. One reading is the reading of Mike McNair and the, you know, the socialist strategy reading, which is the idea that you have a vanguard party that merges with an active workers movement, re-aims its orientation from a collective workers identity to a collective proletarian identity, and starts jiggering politics towards that. The issue that I had with this and then I had with it back then is, one, in practice, it ended up being a developmentalist ideology. It's what leads to the Soviet Union. You end up developing capitalist for production capacity to increase extraction. And by increasing extraction, you develop, you know, what you and I would call capitalist or capitalist adjacent forces. And it leads to that crisis in the 50s and the 60s, where like people are looking at the Soviet Union, communist China, and the United States, and except when it goes really horribly, like in Pol Pot, they can't tell the difference between war capitalism and communism.
Okay, yeah, I know, right? Here's my thought. When you say that it leads to this developmentalist approach, like we saw in the Soviet Union, it's unclear to me to the degree to which we can really say that about the Soviet Union. In other words, for this one reason, in the Soviet Union, the revolutionary subject was not primarily working class or socialist.
Right. Well, the revolutionary subject in any socialist revolution has never been primarily working class stuff.
Right.
That is the key problem.
So in the developed world, where you had a massive proletarian, you had a massive working class people, when they organized politically, they didn't do it as a class for the most part.
Right. Well,
if they did do it along class lines, they did it sector by sector, company by company, industry by industry, trade union by trade union, but they didn't organize as a worker, in as a national worker even. In the United States, other than the Socialist Party of America, which happened in the early 20th century, where there really was a workerist movement of workers.
Not been a workerist movement anywhere on earth that ever achieved more than 45% of the general public, because because immediately upon deindustrialization, people couldn't agree with who the fuck was a worker anymore. And the sectoral competition in capitalism between not just nations. I mean, we always think about it in terms of nations and in terms of races, but just between different sectors of capital,
right,
became very hard to organize anyone across class lines. And like, the only people I've seen really deal with this are, unfortunately, communizers and analytic Marxists who deal with it in different ways. But they both point out that like the 45% real limit was a real problem. Like the dependence on industrial unionization models, as inherited even from the CPA, led to the fact that when they tried to take over through a democratic revolution, they never really had enough people to do it. So when they would really try to appeal to get enough coalitionary allies to go over the 50% hump, they would either become immediately class collaborationists or they would just become fucking populist. They just start talking about the people, like the 99% versus the 1%. And what was interesting about that to me now is that sort of that is both separate from the kind of Marxist-Leninist thing, but it's essentially the same problem, because how did the Marxist-Leninists come to power? It was coalitions of related parties, including some of the quote-unquote comprador bourgeoisie and peasants. And in fact, if you actually look at even the national liberation movements of like the 50s and 60s, a vast majority of their actual cadre force was former peasantry. And what's interesting about that is it also signifies the end of the peasantry as a class in most of these countries. So where does that leave us? And
well, this leads me to go back to Heinrich Grossman in a weird move, because
go ahead.
The theory there is that the proletariat class will be put in a position where it cannot survive without revolution. Just like the peasants were being thrown off their land, you know, their way of life was ending. They could not continue as peasants. That was not a road that was open to them. Go ahead.
Here's the problem with that, though.
I'm not saying
peasants could not continue. I know, but the problem with this logic to me has always been this: when you talk about the peasants, they were dealing with the transition to capitalism. So the feudal and pre-feudal orders that they were coming out of, literally was already dead. So, like, when you talk about that with the working class, you're talking about that happening before the point that capitalism has failed. Like, it's in this instant, if you take the Grossmanite idea, there's an instant of opportunity that is made inevitable in classical Marxism and likely in Grossman's modification of this.
Right. Like the Tsar trying to modernize Russia.
Right. And so
there's that instant where really it's dead. Tsarism is dead. Feudalism is dead, but not dead enough. And there's these things are, go ahead.
Right. So, but there's this the thing that Grossman hits on that I found fascinating is Grossman starts to realize, and he never abandons the final crisis theory, but he starts to realize how damn big these countervailing tendencies are, and how they can destroy enough capital either directly or indirectly to clear up space. Like Grossman figures that out in a way that, like, I'm not saying Marx didn't know it, but definitely when you look at like the 1890s Marxists, they really thought that was impossible.
Well, in the 1890s Marxists, though, weren't clear on what the crisis, whether there even would be a crisis in capitalism. You know, in the 1890s Marxists, that's the moment where there was a crisis in Marxism, where, you know, that's when the monopoly capitalist kind of is socialism idea was born in a way.
I mean, almost literally with the passing away of Engels at that time, like that's when you start seeing, and Engels
and the fact that the big long depression of the 19th century did not end in revolution.
Right. And I mean, and for Grossman, I mean, and to me, this actually, you bring up Grossman is interesting to me for a bunch of reasons, but one, it is kind of in the background, that theory. And Grossman's not the only person who has a crisis theory, but like he's got one of, to my mind, he has the best articulated. Theory.
Yeah.
Right. But he's not.
I want to point out, I do not hold with it. I don't reject it, but I don't hold with it. It's a brand new kind of thing for me. I was not brought up in this tradition in my last, 10 years.
Like Grossman and then in a separate tradition, Ernst Mandel, the Trotskyist, are the two people who believe in final crisis. And they're not quite they're not true immiserationists either, because they realize that total immiseration is actually bad for the working class, but they think that the contradictions are just going to make it untenable. And this was a modification of the inevitability thesis, not just from the monopoly capitalist, but also from Soviet communism, which thought that monopoly capital would lead to competition that would lead to the capitalist world destroying itself. So they took the monopoly capital theory, but instead of seeing it as something you could take over and control, they saw it as something that would cause nation states to destroy each other and create conditions like the condition of the Soviet Union And that their strategy of patience, which was actually something advocated by all different people on the socialist spectrum, would lead to a strategy of patience into the like opportunistic socialism in one country, which is something that Stalin, I don't think, ever actually really believed. Mm-hmm. Like it was for him a stalling tactic. So the problem though is like these two crises. The first crisis is at the end of the Long Depression. The second crisis is at World War II. And right. I guess you can say the third crisis is the end of Keynesianism. And we might be living through these 10 years that, you know, this last 10-year business cycle might be a fourth crisis in which we got blindsided again. Like, if you look at, you know, I admit that, like, the math on long-form Kondratiev waves, you know, the second theory business cycle of long wave. Mm-hmm. I admit that the math on that is awfully close to noise, as far as like how you plot it out. But like, it does seem weird that like these big crises, these like double 10-year ones and these long ones, all happen at about a generation and a half cycle, as predicted by Kondratiev long waves. Mm-hmm. So about every 40 to 60 years. Yeah. And it seems like we're living through one, and we got blindsided again. And one of the things I worry about, because I think the Grossmanite way of looking at things does give you a way of saying, okay, why does capitalism lead to the formation of a proletariat? And the assumption from the monopoly capital school and from the social democrats, and to some reason, even the Marxist-Leninists, is that capitalism would create a large enough proletariat by liquidating the other classes that it would take over either by force or by democratic fiat and then smash the state by force once it did. By sheer universalization of the proletariat. And one of the things that you have after the second crisis of, you know, the World War II crisis, mm-hmm. Is that after that, you really do have the consolidation of, like, the peasantry almost doesn't exist anywhere on Earth anymore. Like, there are some peasants, but they are so peripheral to production that we barely talk about them. Like, so
certainly in the developed world,
right? But even in the developing world, like you look at Mexico, like how what percentage of the population are truly peasants? Almost none. Like right. You're getting into the
well, yeah. I mean, the subsistence farmers lasted longer than the peasant class.
Right. Well, and subsistence farming, weirdly, I mean, that's interesting because it lasted longer than I think Marxists thought it should have. But it is almost gone. And I mean, if you look at like urbanization trends, for example, like it's the majority of the population on Earth, not just in the United States, now lives in cities. I mean, they are by definition not peasantry. And so you have this universalization of the wage fund for like 90% of the population, like maybe more than that. I mean, like I think if we looked at petite bourgeois owners and unless you start counting professionals who draw on the wage fund, but you technically say because of skilled rents or whatever, somehow they're not proletariat. Mm-hmm. It looks like you have the closest thing you were going to ever have to a universalized proletariat. And what I'm trying to figure out is there's no class consciousness in it at all. If anything, there's less class consciousness than there's ever been. And you have it flare up in sectors, you know, like Amazon or whatever, but you don't really have it across the board, like anywhere.
Right. And which is, again, what the terminal crisis is supposed to provide in a way.
Right.
Right. And it's not a matter of consciousness. It's like a matter of a class rising up to survive by transforming itself. By abolishing itself and creating a new economic order in the same way the peasants did.
Right. Well, to me, Harold Cruz and and Lash
yeah,
are
what, group. Yeah.
Are an instantiation though of the same problem. So right. like after this period of time, Doug, you know what emerges? Like after the period, because when we talk about this period of time, we're talking about mid 60s.
Right.
After 68, because this is like The Agony of American Left, I think, is written like in 67. And no, I believe
it's published in 69, right?
69, yeah. But it was written before that. And and it's 67 for the Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, so it's right before 68 and the real flowering of the Black Power movement and the end of the first instantiation of the Civil Rights Movement. Because one of the things Cruz is criticizing is like, get over your fetish for the Watts riots, which, you know, like, ooh,
that never ended.
I have been like, you know, like, guys, you might want to, it both ends and doesn't. Like, it is interesting how Marx is right about how much we just repeat ourselves, like when we're stalled, like, but the next theory that comes out of this is you get Marxist third worldism comes out in the 70s and really gets formalized in the 80s. You get communization theory starts in the late 60s, in the 70s, dies for 20 years and gets picked back up in the late aughts. Yes, Gilles Duvet was still writing during that time period, but no one cared. All these tendencies started emerging to explain why the proletariat had not emerged. And I bring this up because you talked about one of the, you know, you said the history of Marxism is the history of people trying to like hide the fact that they don't really want to deal with what Marx does. And I think to some degree that's true. The other part of the history, though, is the history of Marxism is trying to figure out why the hell we keep on not being able to find that fucking final crisis that's supposed to have already happened.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. Like,
yeah, no.
Like, it's like, that's like the entire thing that everyone's reacting
to. If you're just looking at this from like a sociological or psychological perspective, it's clear that the theory of terminal crisis fills in a gap that we can't fill in our politics, right? That we can't figure out. It fills in a whole bunch of gaps, not just like, why can't we organize the proletariat or the working class? Why is socialism disconnected from the working class? But also, what the fuck is socialism?
Yeah. Like, is it just government doing stuff? Like,
right, yeah, right. I mean, you know, it covers up a whole lot of business if you're if you're too invested in the terminal crisis. And I think that there's a good possibility. I mean, no, I don't know, but my instinct is that we could face something like a terminal crisis, but that the way we will recover from it will be an inhumane bloodletting that will maybe make the Holocaust look like a walk in the park or some shit like that. And
I mean, nuclear war, like that's
yeah, like nuclear war. Yeah, and so we could face in a something like an apocalypse and yet still remain capitalist on the other side of it, or slip into barbarism.
Like right. those yeah, are options, I mean, like you know. I hate, like, I don't want to give this current Yanis Varoufakis, Jody Dean, neo-feudalism theory a whole lot of play. Mm-hmm. But I do think there's a real sense that violent revolution plus rentier relations, which we're already seeing emerge, as part of the evidence of the crisis of profitability and commodity production, that we're just trying to go to straight up rentier relations
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why Jeff Bezos is the king of the world.
Right. Yeah. That could lead to, with the right environmental collapse, lead to something like feudalism. Because to me, like one of my, you know, and we talked about this again, I keep on referencing, this is finally, we're referencing the original Pop the Left. But I talked about this in the end of the original Pop the Left series. Like I got fascinated with, okay, in the late Roman Republic, you have almost everything you need for early capitalism to emerge. And there's a bunch of crises that happen. They never get off slave labor. They do eventually get off slave labor, but because of the failures of production, of political economy, of unable to maintain their laws. I mean, just a bunch of crap. The old Roman private villa system becomes a basis of the European feudal economy until basically the Black Plague makes it completely unviable. Right. So like my thing about terminal crisis theory is a terminal crisis can go in that direction too, because like, if you really think about it, there was no like Rome could have not gone through feudalism, and probably we could have got the capitalism like 100 years earlier.
I mean
1,000 years earlier even.
Yeah. I mean, I you'd have to really walk me through it to convince me, but I think there's something to that. I remember that conversation.
Well, I mean, the feudal mode of production isn't progressive as opposed to the tributary mode, except for the fact it gets rid of slave labor. But just barely, like, and not totally. But slave labor was declining in the Roman Empire in the fourth century anyway.
Right.
So it's just one of those things where.
And how much of a market was developing at that time?
They had a consumables market for commodities with coinage, with everything. There's banking. What there isn't is a large wage laboring class, because wages were largely the providence of state officials and the military. They did draw a wage, but everybody else drew like portions and kind of subsistence land farming. You were able to keep so much of your.
Well, they had to do a certain kind of work in order to get the coinage to pay the taxes to the state.
Right. All right. And when that failed in like middle feudalism, they just stopped using coinage. Like there was coinage like back and forth. If you look at the Scottish Highlands where the coinage system really failed, what they would do is they took payment in kind if you couldn't get the coin, usually at an increase for not being able to get coin. But a lot of serfs and peasants couldn't really get the coin.
So they would pay their taxes in dung.
Yeah, they pay their taxes in whatever they had. So right. Like,
do you ever see the movie Bananas?
Yeah, I have. But it's interesting because to me that shows how like that's a fundamentally breaking down system. Like you can't even enforce coinage anymore. Like,
let's go back to Harold Cruz for one last moment here.
Uh-huh. Go ahead
and ask ourselves the question. Do we at this point, do you think you fully understand what problem Harold Cruz was trying to overcome by advocating for a Black national culture within the United States?
I think he was trying to.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I think he was trying to overcome Black people being steamrolled in a singular collective working class. And the other thing I think he was trying to overcome was the lumpenization of black people under Jim Crow capitalism, under Jim Crow in specific and capitalism in general.
So he was trying to proletarianize Black people in America.
Yeah. And for Black people in his mind, that's a step up, not a step down.
Right. Of course.
People. So, yeah, I mean, like, so that was his goal. And his goal was also in this idea that you like they'd have a seat at the table of nations, even within the United States, like
because they would have a seat in the United States, and the United States had a seat in the table of nations. So to gain political power, he wanted to gain political power as a primarily working class culture and political movement.
Right.
And this must have meant that in 1967, there was still a sense that there was a major political power in the working class.
Right. Although it is a sense that is fading. And so you get the feeling that he thinks part of the problem is that that the working class ethnic groups are being assimilated in the capital by their bourgeoisie, which I think is funny, because if you take him and compare him to let's take someone like Adolf Reed and his son Torrey Reed, they would actually argue the beginnings of the argument are almost identical, but the conclusions are almost opposite. So
right.
The beginning of the argument is like, hey, we're being led by these
bourgeois black intellectual class
who are at a disadvantage against white intellectuals, and they're going to use any weapon at their hand. And Cruz's time, that weapon looks like assimilation. And we, you know, by the 1990s, when Reed's writing, it looks like, you know, it looks like separate, it looks like conservative versions of black power politics. It looks like,
pull up your pants.
Our friend Jason over at This Revolution will talk about it as like, you know, like black entrepreneurship culture and that. Which even the people who sagged their pants still kind of believed in.
Yeah.
And so like,
just believed that they could all be rap stars or athletes, right. You know? Yeah.
So it's just interesting.
Just like I thought I could be a novelist.
Like the same the same observation is given, but because of the difference of the cultural and I think frankly, economic milieus of the time, and maybe more the economic milieus of the time.
Yeah.
The conclusions drawn are diametrically opposed to each other. Although, you know, I don't think I've read Reed write about Harold Cruz, but I know he must know about
him for sure. Yeah.
So
has he written about Christopher Lash?
I don't think so. What's interesting is Lash thinks this is the best form of black Marxism in America at the time, but he also, and I'll read what he says about this, and his critique. He basically says, you know, this is very astute. What is it he says? Just got to find it here. And people must forgive me for using 60s language when I say Negro. But the analysis of the American Negro as an ethnic group should be properly included in study of the role of other nationalist ideologies like Zionist or Irish American nationalism over discover whether they played any important part in the significant efforts of those communities to organize themselves. When I've been able to learn, the Irish American nationalism focused almost exclusively on Ireland and contributed nothing important to the political success of Irish in America. Another study of ethnic nationalism might show the same thing. It is possible, in other words, that the nationalist movements in America, even when they cease to be merely fraternal and convenial and actually involve themselves in revolutionary politics of a homeland, as was true in some of the Irish American movements, they have no practical bearing on the ethnic group politics in America itself. And in that case, nationalism may not serve Negroes as a particularly useful guide to political action, although it is clear that Negro situation demands a sort of action along ethnic lines. There are some further problems of what Cruz means by culture. Some of the words he uses in its broad sense, sometimes narrowly, as when he asked Negro intellectuals to follow the lead of C. Wright Mills by formulating a theory of cultural radicalism. In modern society, Cruz argues, mass cultural communications is a basic industry, and only the blind cannot see that whoever controls the cultural apparatus also controls the destiny of the United States and everything in it. Doesn't this sound familiar? Anyway, this statement is open to a number of objections, and I'm reading Lash here. But quite apart from it, it is not clear what it has to do with what Frazier calls the Negro's primary struggle, to acquire a culture much more basic than the kind of culture Mills and even Cruz in this passage have in mind. How are Negroes to get control of the cultural apparatus until they have solved their more immediate difficulties? And how would their efforts to control the cultural industry differ from the efforts of Lorraine Hasbury and Sidney Poitier, whom Cruz criticizes on the grounds that their personal triumphs on Broadway and in Hollywood did nothing to advance Negro culture? These questions aside, Cruz leaves no doubt of the validity of his main thesis, that intellectuals must play a central role in the movements for radical change, that this role should not consist of formulating a new political philosophy, and that in the 20th century American history, they have failed in this work. They must now address themselves to a more systematic analysis of American society than they have attempted before, building on the social theory of the 19th century, but scrapping the parts that no longer apply. This analysis will have to explain, among other things, how the situation of the Negro in America relates to the rest of American history, a problem which Cruz now has made an impressive assault, without, however, solving the dilemma poised by E.B. Du Bois.
Okay, so can I ask a question here? Did you say that that what the Black intellectual should not do is develop a new political philosophy?
Or that they should? What do you mean, what I read here?
Yeah. Did you say they should not?
They should,
okay.
All right. Yeah, they should. All right, and then I'll just finish on this part. The faces of the American Negro and intricate and subtle problems of combining into one object, two difficult set of facts, that he is both a Negro and an American at the same time. The failure to grasp this point, according to Cruz, has prevented both integrationalists and nationalists, by here means separatists, from synthesizing the composite trends. The pendulum swings back and forth between nationalism and integration, but as with so many discussions amongst American intellectuals, the discussion never seems to progress at the higher level of analysis. Today, riots, armed self-defense, conflicts over control of the ghetto schools, efforts of CORE, which was a group at the time, to move Negroes into cooperative communities in the South, and other uncoordinated actions signify a reawakening of something that can be loosely called nationalism, but they express not a new synthesis, but varying degrees of disenchantment with integration. The advocates of Black power have so far failed to show why their brand of nationalism comes any closer than its predecessors to providing a long-range strategy, not for escaping from America, but for changing it. The dilemma remains, the more than it ever, it needs to become the object of critical analysis. In the meantime, will events wait for analysis? Immediate crisis confronts us, and there is no time, it seems, for long-range solutions, no time for reflection. Should we all take to the streets then, as Andrew Kopkin recommends? In critical times, militancy may appear to be the only authentic politics, but the very gravity of the crisis makes it all the more imperative that radicals try to formulate at least a provisional theory that will serve them as a guide to the tactics in the immediate future, as well as the long-range questions of strategy. Without such a perspective, militancy would carry the day by default, then quickly exhausting itself, it will give way to another cycle of disillusionment, cynicism, and hopelessness.
Yeah.
Which, you know, like that, that's like a punch in the gut, because I'm like, we just saw that in rapid fire.
Yeah. This is why he is so fundamentally aligned with some basic liberal rights, like freedom of speech. It's because mm-hmm. that goes hand in hand with the need for radicals to reflect and develop through reflection.
Right.
If you say we want to direct the culture because and control the culture, we need a culture because that's the steering wheel for society. That's what determines conditions in society is the culture. The ideology and culture is not the owl of Minerva flying at midnight, reinterpreting the world and making it and smoothing over problems, but it is what actually sets our course. I don't buy it.
It's hard for us to blame Cruz for that.
I'm not really blaming Cruz for it. I'm just saying, I want to point out to everyone, let's recognize Cruz is making a mistake and not repeat it.
But the thing is, like, I'm actually disagreeing. I just want to see, like, this theory doesn't die. Ever since the World War II crisis, it has been the primary default mode of, and not just of, like, sub-identity groups within the working class and, like, what,
you oh, know,
because, no. I mean, like, it's been, like,
it's fucking Chomsky's line, in a way.
Right. Right. And workerist assumptions are like this. If we, if we can set the culture by having people, you know, go to working class taste. And I mean, you know, you talked in your recent video about how Lash, and you know, I say Cruz too, could not get out of the binds of their day. Although Lash is probably of this time period, of the people who don't just become post-structuralist,
right? Which he flirts with, I think, at times.
He does flirt with at times, yes, but he doesn't go there. I mean, like, and his flirting with post-structuralism is more obvious in The World of Nations than it is in The Agony of the American Left. But
oh yeah, yeah, no, well, there's hardly a post-structuralism to flirt with in 1969, right? Yeah,
I mean, he's writing about Foucault though, like in the late 60s. It's actually kind of crazy,
right?
He's also, Lash is also trying to develop a critique of what he sees as the Frankfurt School cop-out. And the Frankfurt School cop-out for him isn't just economic. Mm-hmm. It's when they go authoritarian personality and total subsumption to capitalist norms.
Right.
That, like, we have red fascism now or whatever. Yeah. And Lash is like, that's a cop-out. Like, that's like, that doesn't explain anything. Like, even if there's some objective truth to the authoritarian personality thesis, that was true before Capital too. What that doesn't explain much. What you realize, what Lash increasingly, to me, my going thesis on this, and I haven't proven it yet because I'm still going through and reading all his late 80s stuff too. And a lot of articles actually that were published to try to fill in the gaps. That Lash starts thinking about this in terms of building a counter tradition or a workers culture that could speak to the real problems of workers himself. And that he did that in arguing with leftist elites in the academy. And he increasingly was removed from even the history of the worker struggles that he spent up until, I think, probably The Minimal Self, really trying to document. That's why you get, like, you know, that's why things get vaguer and vaguer, and you get you move from talking about, like in early Lash books, particularly in The World of Nations, he's talking about different kinds of American bourgeoisie and elites, and by like the revolt of the elites, it's just like some generic hodgepodge of elites that even like a conservative could probably glom onto. Right. And they do. I mean, like, I hate to use Amazon algorithms for who's buying Lash books, but it's a weird mixture of, like, when you buy a Lash book, all of a sudden my queue gets like, here's these five conservative books, and here's these five books by Thomas Frank, and here's a book by Angela Nagel, and I'm like, oh god, like, so it's left populist and conservatives who are reading this,
right?
And
yeah, and if I go to Culture of Narcissism in Amazon, it says, frequently bought together, The Culture of Narcissism, Revolt of the Elites. Guess what the third title is?
Kill on Normies.
Capitalist Realism.
Oh, that's actually not bad.
No, it's not, but it's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then underneath, books you may like, but this is my, you know, based on my searches, not just this particular one, but Black Shirts and Reds, Mao, On Practice and Contradiction, China Mayville, The Story of Russian Revolution, Michael Pollan, How to Change Your Mind.
Why do I guess I get conservative books because I read in the enemy camp more than anybody else.
Well, books you may like doesn't just indicate books you may like.
Oh yeah, I didn't look at just that. I looked at, like, I think I looked at people who buy this product.
Yeah, right. Frequently bought together is all I'm seeing. And then off to the side, I think you can find, there's another thing to click. But, you know, yeah, other books,
Amazon
I might like, Racecraft, Selections from the Prison Notebooks by Antonio Gramsci, The Player's Handbook for Dungeons and Dragons.
I had not think of anything more accurate and more you than, except for the Gramsci part of that, than the list of books.
Civil War in France, The Paris Commune. All right.
Yeah.
I think that we are now at the end of yet another Pop Left. I enjoyed it. I'm gonna stop recording at this nerdy point.
Yes.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.